If you can go ahead and have some seats, we're going to get started. This is going to be our session on negative debating, and specifically we're going to talk about some techniques, strategies. We're going to talk about some tools that you can use that are going to help you. This is designed to be for everyone, so some of these are going to be a little more advanced than others, but hopefully everything is going to be of use to you. I would encourage you to ask questions if you're not sure about something. This is possibly my favorite lecture to do, and I'll tell you why, and that is because, again, number one, if you stop and think about it, at least half, usually, of your debates are going to be negative debates. And I learned something very early on as a debater, and that was that there is sometimes an actual perverse power that you have in running negative if you do it right. And a lot of it has to do with your philosophy and your attitude, and understanding the different roles that people have. And so I'm going to start with that very thing. Debate philosophy is about your mindset. What you have to do, what you don't have to do, where your strengths and weaknesses lie in the position that you've been given. There are obvious strengths to being in the affirmative position in debate. Obviously, you know what's going to happen because you picked the case, you picked the topic. You hopefully control, to some extent, what is going to happen for the next hour and whatever that you're in that debate. However, you don't want to be thinking necessarily that way, because that's not always the case. An affirmative is like, I kind of liken it to, if you think back to the 1700s, let's say that you're somebody who's trying to take a government ship and you have to get a load of gold from London to Barbados. Okay? That's a very regimented thing. It's insured. There's a schedule. You hire a crew. You get everything ready to go. It's very predictable. You set the parameters, and you expect everything to hopefully go the way you want it to go. Similarly, if you're an affirmative in a debate, what you want to do is carry all the stock issues, respond to every argument, have no loose ends. You want to have everyone know exactly what they're supposed to do, or persuade the judge, and you're going to get an affirmative ballot. And the ship's going to leave London and head for the Barbados, and it's going to be on this predictable route. And here's the problem. The pirates know that. The pirates know that. So what do you do? Well, folks, you think like a pirate. Okay? When you're a negative debater, you know what the affirmative's got to do. There's no predictability necessarily to being a negative. You're not required to do the same things, are you? Right? As a negative, you have tremendous freedom. You can pick any place in that route from London to Barbados to attack that ship and take that gold, couldn't you? You don't have to be in the predictable place they expect you to be. You could be someplace else. You could use the weather. You could, you know, come out of nowhere, right? You could be outside the box. You can be creative. Similarly, when you're debating, you can be outside the box too. You could say, you know what I'm going to do? They're used to everyone running significance arguments against this, whatever. I'm not going to do that. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to run 10 dis-ads. I'm going to run 5. My partner's going to run 5. That's what we're going to do. We're going to make them earn their money. We'll make them run around. Can I do that? Sure. I'm the negative. I can do whatever I want, right? Within reason. It's a freedom. Think about it. You're free to do whatever you want to do. You can make any arguments you choose to make. And you can surprise people, and you'd be unpredictable, and sometimes it can wreck that ship going to the Barbados like nothing else. Because sometimes an unpredictable negative is the most scary thing there is in a debate round. And I personally find a lot of power in that. I really do. So, I encourage you, first of all, as a negative debater, to not be hemmed in. Be creative. Get outside the box. What do I mean by that? A lot of different things you can do. We'll talk about some of them. Okay? But be creative is the number one thing I want to tell you to do. Be creative. Develop different arguments. Find different ways to create a different viewpoint of what's going on for the judge. And that's the last thing I'm going to tell you, is that keep in mind, it's the judge's opinion that counts. So if you can convince the judge to come along with you on a ride to talk about something completely different, that somebody doesn't understand, that maybe the affirmative team has never heard of or seen or whatever, sometimes that can take the debate in an entirely different direction. And all of a sudden you find the affirmative team is desperately fighting the fight of their life to try to overcome some argument they've never heard before, and they get flustered, and I've seen this happen way too many times. A really good affirmative team that's used to winning every time on a really good plan runs into somebody who just gives them something completely out of left field, and now they're desperate. They're in the fight of their lives to try to win a debate that they don't understand what happened. I had this under control, and this guy came in with his arguments, and all of a sudden I can't find any evidence. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, and they panic, and before you know it, the judge is voting negative. You've turned the tables. Nothing wrong with being creative. Take it as a license and a philosophy to do something different. Okay, so I'm not going to just tell you a philosophy and call it a day. I'm actually going to give you some ways that you can do that maybe you can employ. Okay, strategic negative debate, big picture stuff. Most negative debates are won the month before the tournament. I'm going to say that again. Most negative debates are won before the tournament. How? It's how you prepare. Can you prepare stuff ahead of time? You betcha. You know a lot of the stuff that's happening. You can get the source books. You can do research online. You've heard the cases that came out of the tournaments. You know some of the stuff. So what can you do with that? Well, a debate partner of mine used to have a couple of very useful philosophies. Number one, he never wanted to lose to the same case twice. So he would go and research their case, and he would know it better than they did the next time it came around. And he would have researched some material and have some negative evidence and maybe something they never heard before. And that was very useful for beating that case. Second philosophy that he always seemed to have when we were debating as a negative was that he didn't want them to feel that they were safe. In other words, you may have run that case once, but the next time we're going to run it something completely different at you. We're not going to go at you with the same things we did last time. And again, that can be frustrating for an affirmative team. Now, your research can help you a lot. The other thing I was going to say that you can do is you can research negative briefs that are generic things. For example, you can probably think of a couple of themes that are going to probably keep coming back over and over and over again this year. We talked about electronic surveillance, things like liberty or the actual ability to achieve any kind of benefit from law enforcement or from foreign intelligence sources on metadata or wiretaps or whatever. Those basic concepts of things. There's a lot of people out there who are going to say things, who are going to make statements, whatever, on the internet. To the extent that you can put together some quotes and string some stuff together that you can use as a generic brief. So let's say someone comes up with a new case you've never heard before, but guess what? It's still talking about the same basic concepts. You can maybe use your generic brief and read some cards and have something to argue to the judge, even though you've never even heard or seen or looked up that case that they're running. There's lots of different ways to approach it. Here's another one. Cut and pasting from source books and creating a negative notebook. If you see a great card that you're saying to yourself, well, that's a nice generic card, that's something I could use in something else, great. I'll tell you something else you should also do. Read the other affirmative cases in a source book. Now, why do I say that? Well, because sometimes the evidence that's in that case, whether it's inherency or solvency or significance or whatever else, might be a really good piece of evidence to run against another case. Stop and think about that for a minute. Sometimes the best pieces of negative evidence are buried in affirmative cases on other topics. Have you ever gone through a source book and read all the cases and looked at the evidence in that way? Suddenly, you might have a whole another set of pieces of evidence that you could use. Just think about it for a minute. I've actually done that fairly successfully, pulled some stuff out of nowhere because people weren't expecting it. If you pull a card out of another case, they maybe never heard somebody run it quite that way. Again, especially if you're being creative. I'll tell you something else that you might not have thought about. Especially when you get about halfway through the year, if you're a judge and you're hearing a case that people have been running all year, and you're hearing the same, you know, tired negative arguments that you've heard all year, sometimes you can finish the card for them when they start it. It's that bad. What a breath of fresh air when some negative gets up and reads all different kinds of cards and things. I mean, you're at that point, if you're not rooting for that person, you're just not living, you know? It's an advantage. Be different. Be creative. It can help you in a lot of different ways. It helps you grow as a debater, too. Okay, also, talk to your coaches. Find out what other kinds of cases they might have heard that you didn't hear. Maybe there's some other cases out there that you haven't prepared for. Again, talk to your friends. You know, I know, you know, some of you have been to tournaments and some haven't, but usually the tournament at lunchtime, everybody's talking about whatever the hot case is that some team is running. Listen in. Ask good questions. Well, how did they run the solvency on that exactly? Oh, well, I think it was such a, well, let me pull out my flow. Before you know it, you've learned all about that case that you didn't even hit, but now you know about it, and you can go back and research it. So the next tournament you go to, you might have some cool evidence that you can run against it. Again, strategically, use the time you have to be effective. Okay? And, well, some pirates are taller than others. Again, prepare your neg briefs. Can you use generics? Don't limit yourself. Is there a source indictment? That's another good thing. How many people know what a source indictment is? Okay. Let me tell you what a source indictment is. This is when you have a piece of evidence that says that a particular source person, or maybe like a think tank or something, is biased, wrong, you know, whatever, make, you know, figure it out. So, for example, you might have a piece of evidence that says, well, anything that comes out of the Cato Institute on energy policy is all flawed because their primary researcher is this person and they've been indicted for lying or making stuff up or whatever else in 1998 or whatever. Okay, what does that do? Well, let's suppose that you don't have a single piece of evidence about whatever the affirmative is running for a case. But you notice that like 3/4 of their cards are all from the Cato Institute, and it's an energy case. Now what can you do? You read your source indictment. You say, Judge, you can't trust any of this stuff that, you know, 3/4 of the cards in their case are all from the same group. What have you just done? You have really end run that ship. And now they've got a whole different problem that they maybe never had before. Now maybe they have heard that card before. Maybe they got a response, but you don't know. So you take your chances. The good news is that oftentimes a source indictment is a really good way, especially if a judge already has a bias, or maybe the hint of a bias about somebody, reading a source indictment might push him over the edge. You never know. Now again, just saying. But it's a different way to go. If you haven't thought about things in those terms, now maybe that's a different way to look at it strategically. What if you had a whole brief full of source indictments that you could use? Again, you have to know which ones you have, because if you don't know you have them, you'll never know to use them. Okay, can you prop up the status quo? I talked about this before, but I just want to mention it again. Sometimes it can be just as good, even if you don't have evidence against affirmative case, to argue why what's going on in the status quo is so good that we shouldn't change it. So, for example, suppose you have tons of evidence that says very pointedly that anything that we do with wiretapping has had tremendous success, and it's put all these criminals away, and it's saved, you know, millions of lives or whatever else. It doesn't really matter necessarily what kind of affirmative case they're running. If they're running a case that talks about that kind of thing, you could run those cards. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Sometimes that's a powerful thing to have in your arsenal as a negative debater. And the last thing is kind of I want to talk about it a little bit, but can you find a different source for the harms? This is something that I really like to do, and I think that it can be very powerful, and I like it as a judge when I hear it. So, for example, let's suppose you have an affirmative, and they're running a case, and they say the harms are that we have these decreases in liberty or something caused by, you know, these government laws about electronic surveillance. Okay? Suppose you had some evidence that showed that the real source of our loss of our liberty was not electronic surveillance laws, but rather, I don't know, Congress run amok, or the fact that they have a designated hitter rule in the American League, or whatever it is. If you can argue to the judge with a straight face that whatever it is that the affirmative's telling you is the cause of these harms is really caused by something else, and therefore their plan, which is not about the thing your card says caused that harm, is going to be worthless in terms of solving it. You've at least given the judge a whole different thing to think about in terms of, hey, or the other thing you can do, by the way, the ultimate on this is to argue that whatever these harms are, they're too big to be solved by anything. For example, you could argue, well, the Middle East crisis will never be solved by anything. Period. It just can't be solved. There's no way to solve it. And you need lots of cards out there on things like that. Or the oil crisis will never be solved. Or, you know, whatever. Electronic surveillance can never be solved. There is no way to resolve this. If you can find an expert that says that, well, guess what? You're defending the status quo, right? You don't need to solve the harms. You could argue these harms are too big to ever be solved. Therefore, there's no reason to go with this affirmative plan. It's just a waste of time, money, energy, possibly causing dis-eds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You follow me?
Yes.
And that's something that you can generically put in your bag that even if you had no other evidence against that affirmative plan, maybe it came out of left field, but you could still argue that the harms are too big to be solved if they're addressing harms that you've got evidence on. Strategically, you can have something in your bag, in your toolbox, that you can use that even if the case is something that you've never heard before, the plan is totally new, as long as they're still addressing the same old tired harms, you've got a way to argue against it. And it sounds really cool when you do it. Okay. So third thing we're going to talk about is tactical. And I apologize ahead of time. I did serve in the United States Air Force, so I do think in terms of strategic and tactical. And by the way, in case you're wondering, strategic just means something that applies, something that you do to try as a strategy overall to try to get something to happen in general. Tactical means I've got a problem, I've got an attack, I've got something going on right now, and I'm going to solve it. That's all the difference is, really. Tactical means zooming in on something particular. So in this case, what is the first thing you want to do if you're going negative? It helps you win the round after the round starts. Now, obviously, strategic was before the round starts. Now the round started, so now we got to deal with the issue at hand. So what do? Flowing. You have to flow well. If you don't know what the arguments are, how can you make responses? I say this all the time. You have to learn to properly and effectively flow the arguments. I will repeat this as many times as there are moments in the day to say it. However, now that I've said that, specifically, get what you can get, but more importantly, write down summaries of what the evidence actually said and contrast it with the tagline they read. So, for example, if they say something like, well, millions will die, and then you listen to the card, and the card says something about, well, you know, maybe back in 1978, 1,000 people were impacted, but I'm not sure that's even true anymore. Well, wait a minute. That card doesn't say millions will die. It says something else. Call them on it. Push them on it. That's one of the things you should do is a negative. If you can, make notations of really key, you know, sources or cards or whatever that they're reading, or ask to look at the evidence and make a note down and go Google it later or look it up and see if you can find out if, you know, read the whole article, you may find that there's a whole different slant on it. I know my old debate partner used to make a lot of hay on people by going out and looking up the articles they were quoting from and finding out that the article didn't say what they said it said.
In fact, I would tell you that the very best, and Emily and Jeremy, who are you all? There you are. Didn't the very best negative evidence that we found last year come from the affirmative articles? And I've said that for years. The very best negative evidence you ever find is usually in the affirmative zone material. Because later on in the article it'll say, but other experts don't think that's true. And the other experts say, that's baloney. And it'll go on in their article, and you find out, oops, okay, this is what they didn't read.
Yeah.
And you cite that in the debate round, and it blows the judge away. They say, oh, really? I wonder what else they're not telling me.
You lose credibility with a judge, you're pretty much done. Now, obviously, that's strategic versus tactical, so I should put it in the other slide. But anyway, same. Obviously, it's still good advice. Okay. What do you do during the prep time after they read the first affirmative constructive? What's the best use of your tactically of your time? Use material you got from the cross-examination. Number one, if you get up there and you're cross-examining the first affirmative constructive, and you don't use all 3 minutes. As far as I'm concerned, that's a crime punishable by going to debate jail. And you should be immediately convicted. Even if you've got to stand up there and read the phone book. If you're depriving your partner of that prep time, you know, you seriously are being a bad partner at the very least. Assess your available resources. I mean, I tell this story to people and sometimes they don't believe it, but it's true. If you haven't looked at the resources you have, then they're worthless. I actually sat in a debate round at a tournament once, for District 9 of NCFCA. And I was sitting there as a judge, and I was listening to a debate, and I heard a case that I'd heard before, and the negative team was sitting over there, and they seemed completely befuddled about what to do and what to argue about this case, and they were supposedly a fairly, you know, senior team. And then, to my utter amazement, I looked, and they had a blue book sitting on their table, and they weren't looking in it. And so, I literally wrote on the ballot afterwards, "By the way, there's a really good brief on this subject on page 63 of that blue book you have on the table in front of you. You know, I would suggest you might want to read it before you hit this case again." There you go. If you don't utilize the tools you have, they're worthless. So you have to know what's in there, which means you should read them. Whatever source book you have, read them. You have to know what you've got to know that you can use them. Finally, prioritize material. Not every issue is a winner. Okay? You might have, and think about it in these terms, because you should think about it in these terms. You're probably at most, if you're pretty fast, you and your partner might be able to make about, you might be able to read about 14 cards between the two of you in two constructives. At the most, that's probably about as many as you'll make. Now, you might make a few more arguments if they're logical arguments not using cards, but what I'm saying is there's a limit to how many cards you can read in a round, period, just how fast you can go. So if you've only got the ability to make 10 to 14 arguments in a round, are you making the best ones? Are you making the one that's easiest to find? Tactically, you should be looking for the best weapon and finding the best arguments and only using those if you can. Now, if you've only got 10 things to do, well, that makes it easy. You know which 10 you're going to do because you only got 10. But most of the time, available to you are probably 20, 30, 40 arguments. Which 10 to 14 are you going to do? And again, I want to do, in my prep time before I get up as a 1NC, I want to make sure I'm talking with my partner, I'm communicating. Well, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And then my partner will say, okay, well, this is what I'm going to do. Now, why are we doing that? Two reasons. Number one, believe it or not, I have been in debates where the 1N will get up and read a series of cards, and then sure enough, the 2N will get up, in the middle of their stuff, they'll start reading the exact same card their partner already read. Because they weren't communicating. Okay?
Never should happen.
Never should happen. It's a complete waste of time. If you want to use that card to support your argument, just simply say, by the way, remember the card that my partner read is the second solvency card about the such and such and so and so. Cross-apply that to my first dissad about blah, 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 blah. You don't have to read the card again. Just refer to it. Cross-apply it. Second thing is, and again, this is about communication, it sounds a whole lot more effective if I get up and I make some solvency arguments, and then I can wrap that up with the judge by saying, now, by the way, judge, I just gave you four solvency arguments, four reasons why their case won't work. However, I want you to make sure you listen closely for my partner's 2N speech when he gets up, because he's going to give you five disadvantages to tell you not only will the plan not work, but here's five reasons why you shouldn't vote for it because of these other cost problems it's going to cause. Boom, boom, boom. Sounds like we've got a coordinated attack. It sounds cool when you do it to the judge. Okay. And last thing is, again, don't be afraid to use a logical response if you can, especially if you don't have a lot of evidence, you might have to. But just make sure that what you're doing makes sense, and also make sure it fits with your partner. I have heard several times where someone will get up and they'll say, here's my logical argument, why this, that, and the other thing. And then their partner will get up and they'll totally sabotage the logical argument you just made. Or vice versa, you'll read three evidence cards and they'll get up and make a logical argument that completely sabotages the argument you're making. Think and coordinate first as best you can. It is a team game after all. Okay. Pool all the winners. Be honest about your ability. 5 to 7 points. Talked about that. Be honest about how long it takes you to read a piece of evidence. By the way, you know, for a trivia thing here, does anyone know why we call pieces of evidence cards? Oh, hands all over the place. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. Books. Right on the table.
From what I've heard. Yeah, from what I've heard. Yes, they would. And they would cut them out and paste them on cards. And they would have a little card file and you'd pull them out.
We actually had a source book in 1979 called Cut and Paste. That was the name of the source book.
Yeah.
Which tells you what they expect you to do with it.
Yeah, in fact, it would be a source book and the page would just literally be blocks of cards all set up in blocks and you would cut them out and then you would paste them on index cards and then you'd put them in a file and they would each have a number at the top. Like top right corner, and then you'd have an outline that would tell you what the information was and what number card it was. And so you would go through and you'd pull out each card and you'd clip them together, little paper clips, and then that's what you're going to read on solvency and this is reading disads and stuff like that. It was, well, it was archaic, but it was interesting at the time. Anyway, move on. I mentioned about prioritizing cards, prioritizing arguments. I'll just say this as a public service announcement. Generally speaking, if you've got a really good topicality argument to make, that's always a good thing to do. However, be honest about how good that topicality argument is because they don't win that often. So if it's not strong, then I'd much rather you read a great solvency card than to make a weak topicality argument. It's just as a matter of actual honest, being honest about how what's effective and what's not, they're more effective oftentimes than some weak topicality argument. If you can make it in 20 seconds and it's a throwaway, okay, I understand that you've made that decision tactically, but what happens usually is because it's a weak topicality argument, people tend to sit up there and they realize it's weak and they're about halfway through it and they try to bolster it and before you know it, they've blown 2 minutes of their 8-minute constructive on this argument that's going nowhere. You know, it's better to cut bait and move on. Okay, work cross-examination responses into both your arguments. Yeah, and again, for those of you who are novices, be consistent with your abbreviations and acronyms on your flow. I've seen too many times where people have abbreviated electronic surveillance like as EES in one place, and then someplace else it's like ELECTS or something like that, and they're looking at it and they actually forget what they wrote, what one thing meant or what different thing meant. Be consistent with your abbreviations and your acronyms is a big help in terms of writing a good flow that you can read. For the more experienced people, or anybody for that matter, repeatability to taglines and slug lines is really, really cool. If you can get up there and you can talk about the, you know, I guess electronic surveillance year, if you can talk about the erosion of liberty in this country is blah, 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 or you can talk about the...
We had a slug line in the round that I judged. I think you used it, Ryan. It was called microscopic impact.
There you go.
And then the explanation is, well, they're only searching 0.07% of the emails. Mm-hmm. But that little slug line, microscopic impact, if that comes up in rebuttals, the judge remembers that, oh yeah, this only has a microscopic impact.
And it has two or three effects that are really good. Number one, judges like those things. They're kind of cool and they're catchy. Number two, it makes it an easy way to refer to something. So you can say, my microscopic impact disad or whatever, you know, okay. Now everyone knows what you're talking about because why? Because it's got a cool name on it. And you don't have to repeat the whole argument again. Everyone remembers it pretty well just because of that catchy line. So you can actually save yourself time by not having to make the whole argument out each time. And again, sometimes it's just one of those things, like I said, that's got a cool factor to it. Sometimes what'll happen is you catch the other team using your taglines like that, but they don't realize they're reinforcing your argument, not theirs. So, for what it's worth.